My name is Tom Chick. You're listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. We are going to be discussing Clash of the Titans, the remake, not the 1980.
Oh, I didn't see it.
And one. That's okay. You can tell us about.
Nobody did. It was too dark to see it.
Spoiler.
So that one of those guys was Christian Mirzaski. Hello, Christian.
Mirzaski is close. How long is this music going to go? I love this.
Yeah, I can
wait, it was totally going with his introduction.
Mirzaski, is that what you said? Actually, my name is Drago. I fight from Soviet Union. I fight all my life and never lose.
Okay, first of all, Dingus, Mads Mikkelsen is a Finn? Oh, no, a Swede? No, he's not a Finn. He's a Swede. How dare you? And he would probably be very offended that you're calling him Russian. We also have with us Kelly Wand. Do you have a tagline that has anything to do with Clash of the Titans, or did you just come up with a tagline that has nothing to do with it?
Interesting.
Oh, damn it. Oh, God, when did it say? Is that what he says about the lightsaber?
No.
That's interesting.
It's after Hades eats a bunch of
Ralph.
Dudes.
Yeah. Ralph
wait, I have a new catchphrase. In Russia, Titans clash you.
Very good.
I came up with that just now.
Now, Kelly Wan, just to get people up to speed who may not have seen Clash of the Titans, and by the way, if you have not seen Clash of the Titans, don't worry, you can still listen to the podcast.
You can just listen to the synopsis. And
yeah, so Kelly Wan, just lay out for people what happens in this movie.
Okay, so this fisherman sucks really bad, and he can only catch babies and moms, but he blames Poseidon for his incompetence, even though in his defense we never see Poseidon in the movie, even though I prayed to him. So he adopts the kid he finds in the ocean, Perseus, who's the rape baby of Zeus, and Perseus hates the gods because he's a theophobe, and everybody in the movie hates the gods because they're all theophobes, even though we never see the gods do anything lame, except after their statues get pulled down, which makes them sick their harpies on the city, but the harpies never do anything. So Perseus hates the gods and blames them for everything.
Go on, don't let the music distract you.
Okay. Perseus hates the gods, and the queen of the city brags about her daughter's hotness. So Hades shows up and he kills her and announces they're going to sacrifice her in the field. And he tells Zeus that Zeus lives on their love and he lives on their fear. And Zeus goes, understandable. So they all set out and reluctantly kill monsters. And Perseus learns to love himself. And he kills Medusa. And the Jake Busey character from Contact has the whole city enthralled. Well, they're really just doing what they do anyway. Which is sacrifice the hot chick instead of everyone. So then Hades tells Zeus he lives on fear, but this time it's a reveal and it's a trick. And Perseus shows up and his Pegasus doesn't crash into the clover field. And it turns to stone and falls over, which would still kill everybody, but it turns out okay. And Perseus turns down the hot chick and ruling the city because Sam Worthington has another 3D franchise coming out 2 months from now.
That was beautiful, Kelly.
And Bubo!
Pay no attention to Bubo.
That was very well done. All right, well, I think we're done.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Oh, yeah, so the gentleman in back. Yes.
When he whips out the Medusa head, wouldn't that just turn everybody in Argos who's watching him do it into stone?
I think because he thrusts it in front of Cloverfield.
What about the head?
What do you mean, what about the head? He kept
it. Not say
I was making a
head. Please.
I was making a penis joke.
Yeah.
Oh.
I thought it was a great movie. I want to see it again. But this time in 2D.
The 3D that we saw, I mean, actually, I think just as a 3D film, it's already bad enough, but the 3D did nothing for it. I just thought it was a worst-case example of 3D, I thought.
It was a last-minute decision to do that.
So and it showed.
Yeah, they made us wait to see that.
It's not that the 3D did nothing for it, it's the 3D actively hurt it, I think.
seeing it with those glasses, I mean, the harpies stuff, you could barely tell. It was like watching harpies with sunglasses, and you're, well, what the hell are those harpies doing? You can't see anything.
Right.
Maybe
they would look like that in 2D. Maybe we're giving it too much credit.
Well, there were times that I was like, screw these glasses, and I just took them off and watched the movie, and it was perfectly fine. I wonder, too, how much of a problem was, because we all saw it together. Maybe at our particular screening, the screen wasn't bright enough or something, which would surprise me, because we saw it at a good theater. But it was so surprisingly dark. At first, these clouds come out, the first harpy attack, and I was like, okay, well, they're intentionally doing it dark. But even the supposedly bright scene seemed too dark. I just thought it was a terrible example of
that. Dance movie looked awesome and bright.
That, you know what, you're right. Yeah, there was no lighting
in the preview for a Step Out 3D.
Yeah, which I will go see.
Well, that movie was
dances
clearly,
are battles in it.
Yeah.
Well, that movie was clearly made for 3D. I'm done with 3D. I'm done with any of this retcon 3D bullshit. I'm done. I'm done watching 3D if I have to watch it with glasses. I'm done with any movie that is an also-ran, hey, let's do 3D as a tack-on. I'm
right.
done.
Which is,
I don't want to see it anymore.
They said they're going to do it with every movie, so you're banning all movies.
Well, no, I just will see it in 2D. I'm with Dingus. I wished I'd seen this. I mean, I wished I hadn't seen this. This was a terrible movie, but I would have just as soon seen it in 2D. I didn't.
Well, how about we just limit our moratorium to movies, like he said, just where it's the last second decision? Because Avatar was designed to be in 3D.
Well, the thing is, exactly, you can see
it took
movies
forever to make.
Right, you can see movies in 2D. I mean, this is, you know, there are plenty of screenings of Clash of the Titans in 2D.
Right.
So. But it made me like Avatar more, Tom. Avatar made me like District 9. This movie made me appreciate Avatar a little more.
You know what movie this made me appreciate? Clash of the Titans is the I think it's at last the movie that makes 300 look like a masterpiece.
Wow.
That's how I felt watching this.
Won't Sam Worthington look weird in 2D to us now? Because now we only see him in 3D.
I hate to say this because I feel kind of mean. I would totally be content with never seeing that guy again. He's been in three absolute duds from my.
And he plays the same dude, and he always says the round head.
He has all of the screen presence of Lucas Black playing Jeep Hansen in Legion.
And
I would have rather seen Lucas Black play Perseus. No joke.
He's not even 3D in 3D. He's so flat.
Yeah.
That was good.
What a waste. Yeah.
That belongs. You should write that down.
Mm-hmm. It's awful. I feel terrible for him. I mean, he's just nothing. There's nothing.
He might
there.
Be the greatest actor in the world, but we don't know it. Because he's only in crappy blockbusters.
Well, okay, so here's one of the less terrible alligator movies called Rogue, which is directed by the guy who did Wolf Creek. Rogue isn't terrible, but it's not very good. It's an early Sam Worthington performance where you wouldn't necessarily know that he sucks. Like, he's okay in it. And he plays sort of the opposite. He's the sort of hero in the piece, opposite.
But he's in 2D, and then that's where
he's in
2D. Shines.
You're right.
Yeah.
That's where he shines in 1D. not that recasting this film is going to make it any better, but, I mean, who else could have played it? Keanu Reeves? Who else is going to be able to play this movie with less?
Well,
Warner Brothers is American, Sam Worthington.
Is this like a studio thing, Kelly Wand? Are all of are Avatar and Terminator Salvation all Warner Brothers movies?
Terminator was Fox and Warner Brothers, confusingly. Money changed hands, but Avatar was only Fox. And Fox is kind of dumber than Warner. It's just Warner's just kind of dumb, too. They like to ruin things. But, but now Fox got lucky with Avatar, so now they're thinking.
Well, this actually did fairly well over the weekend. I was a little surprised. It was $64 million. I was like, what kind
of... How much of that is because of the 3D extra money?
Like, good
they
point.
They made people see it in 3D for $5 more.
Yeah. And how much of
so
that...
How much would that have been if it had only been 2D?
Right, exactly. And how much of that was
off and he contributed to it, right?
It makes a significant difference. That difference in box office makes a significant difference, and it artificially inflates the box office numbers for these movies.
Let's see what the drop-off is. And why, I don't know.
Well, it has to be precipitous. This movie is horrible. I mean, we haven't necessarily laid our cards on the table. This movie is unrelentingly horrible.
What was your favorite dumb thing in it?
My favorite. I'm going to go first. My favorite. One of my favorite dumb things, and it's why I dug up an MP3 of Yakety Sax, was the Pegasus flying around like a drunken bumblebee. I'm like, who is going to ride that thing? That was the worst Pegasus ever. The moment they came out there, I mean, it was just so funny how earnestly they glued wings on these poor horses.
He gets the black Pegasus. Was that like a?
But it's a clearing
Jackson trick.
It's a clearing full of Pegasuses or Pegasi. When
yeah.
The point is that there's one Pegasus left because who is it? Caliban has killed them all, and he has to rescue them. But instead, it's just a clearing full of Pegasuses. One flies in.
He gets a freebie.
And, yeah, and chooses him. You get the black one. Yeah, very nice. There's no reason why he gets it. He doesn't.
Right.
He has to do less.
It's another gift from the gods. Even though he keeps talking about how he doesn't need the gods, but he gets a free horse that he would be lost without. He'd totally fail 3 times in the movie if it weren't.
Remember how ridiculous it was when he tamed the creature in Avatar? He has to do less in this movie to get this creature.
Yeah, he doesn't have to tame it, but he tames it in the original one, right? Didn't you see the original one?
He frees it. He free the.
It's creature. A huge plot point, right?
Yeah, it's important. In this, it's just a clearing full of flying horses. Why? Why do we even need flying horses? Why can't we just have a bird? It's just, this movie is worthless.
And it's Sam worthless. And Andromeda's his girlfriend in the original one, right?
Well, in the Edith Hamilton. I mean, that's the original mythology. They get married.
Why'd they take that out?
Because Gemma Arterton is hotter. How did you say her name?
No, Andromeda was hotter than her.
Are you crazy, Kelly Wand? Gemma Arterton was. She was. She's.
Her character was too annoying and ruined. I couldn't.
I'm not talking about her character. So what? Did you see Quantum of Solace?
Yeah.
She was Strawberry Fields in that, and it's one of those instances where you're like, wait a minute, why isn't she?
All right, I take back everything I just said. She's good in that.
Kelly, what's your favorite dumb thing? Because I totally jumped on Tom's.
Come back to me. I forget now.
Dingus, what's your favorite dumb thing?
Oh, I know.
Oh, okay. Back to Kelly Wand.
When the guy proudly tells Perseus, "Till the men did this," and then he turns to stone, like he just did something awesome, and then shatters.
But with a smile.
Yeah. Like, he just did something awesome.
Well, he did, didn't he?
He didn't do anything. He threw him the sword. But he had time to say that line before being turned to stone. Like, if you have that much time to say the line, then just...
You could just look away.
Just close your eyes, dumbass.
Yeah. Perseus puts it in the bag without looking. So can't they all... I don't know.
All right. So Dingus, what was your favorite dumb thing?
Ease your storm.
Oh, that was good. I like that. That was like a Coen Brothers line.
There was, speaking of a Coen Brothers line, wasn't there a, didn't someone tell him to accept the mystery? Or there was a line very much like the Asian guy tells Larry in his office. I'm trying to remember it, and I didn't, so I failed that.
There's "Don't mess with Hades." There's "Do nothing." Oh. That's a great line. "Do nothing."
I am for that line.
There's did they flip coins back then? By the way, did they have heads or tails in ancient Greece? Because there's a coin flip there when Chewbacca reaches in and grabs the coin.
Ah,
yeah.
Chewbacca. That guy talks English for his last line. He's learned it.
That was, I wanted to mention, in addition to favorite dumb things, my favorite Kelly Wand moment, which replaces for me my favorite audience moment during this, since I actually got to see this movie with Kelly Wand, which is a precious moment in my life. And my favorite moment is is Kelly Wand's Chewbacca. that was
after they all announce that they're going to help him, and then you get, like, the Scooby-Doo growl from the scene.
He says, whatever you're supposed to be.
Yeah. What did he say?
That sounded like Grover, Dingus.
He's the monster at the end of this movie. Except he's not.
I like the dude with the scorpion in the city, too, doing nothing at the end. I like that also.
Oh, the two guys from Willow, I liked them.
So my favorite thing about – actually, I'm changing my favorite dumb thing to the guy from – who obviously – he looks like someone you'd meet in Oregon, but he's gone to Burning Man. The fact that he becomes de facto spiritual leader of the city, that guy was just amazing.
Yeah, he's yeah. Well, so what did he represent? The guy who believes in the gods, who doesn't like Zeus or something.
He represents a Burning Man attendant. He's somebody straight out of Burning Man, and I loved that guy. I'm jealous of the actor who got that part. That was the best part in the movie, by the way.
Shake you see.
That guy was
literally Burning Man because he sticks his hand in the fire.
That's right, exactly. Yeah.
It's delightful.
The gods didn't appreciate his efforts because he gets crushed to death.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's when
That just goes to show gods do suck.
Yeah.
Perseus is right.
You know, I went through a lot of this and got angry about a lot of points of this movie. You're sort of looking at it as a serious movie in the ways it could have been a good movie if it had chosen to be. And I don't know if I even want to attack it from that now because it's so unremittingly bad. But I do kind of want to talk about how this could have been a good movie.
It could have been a good movie so easily.
I want to hear what you guys think. How are you going to fix it? So, Dingus, go ahead. How could this be a good movie?
Well, I'm not sure how to attack this because I'm thinking about the original, which I didn't get to see again.
Ah. Oh.
And I'm thinking about how joyously, well, for me at least, in my memory, how campy it is. And this movie doesn't even rise to camp. And so I'm sort of in a quandary here over the value of camp and should we make a movie that's campy or should we make a movie that sort of seriously deals with and revels in how great mythology can be, because I have a real passion and love of mythology. It's one of those first things I remember studying in school as a fifth and sixth grader that really captured my imagination, and I really got excited about learning. And I remember reading Edith Hamilton and getting so excited and just wrapped up in mythology and how much passion there is there and how this movie completely disregards and couldn't care less about any of that, couldn't care less about mythology.
Which is ironic because mythology would be better. It would make the movie good.
It certainly would, but do we want to bother talking about that? Because I can think of a number of ways this could have been a great movie. There's one turning point at the beginning that I really thought, ooh, there's an idea here that is both ancient and modern that you could really make some interesting comments and still make an action film, and it's completely disregarded because this film is only interested in shortcuts and vomiting. It's just horrid, but I don't even know if we want to bother. I'm so frustrated right now.
That seems foreign to me, Dingus, because I cannot imagine this movie isn't even good enough to be frustrated by. I mean, this is one of the maybe I just see so many more movies than you do and sit through so much more drag that I sort of know how to.
Tom, don't you think? Like, mythology is so – it lends itself to this stuff. It should be good. It would be so easy to just take the mythology and play it straight.
I think a model that could work is Wolfgang Peterson's Troy. Where I adore the Iliad, and the Iliad is a huge part of, like, you talking about Greek mythology, Dingus, I felt the same way about the Iliad. So seeing Wolfgang Peterson attack Troy from a different kind of perspective and throw in some camp, but still in a strange, campy, over-the-top way, honor the material. Maybe that approach could have worked with this. I don't know.
Troy's better than this.
Troy's yard's better than this. I mean, there's a moment where Perseus does an attack on whoever is.
Yeah, the little jumpy attack.
Yeah, the jumpy attack.
And I'm like, I want to watch Troy now.
Exactly. That is exactly what I thought. Oh, that's the Brad Pitt thing.
Remember how good Troy was? Yeah.
But
I see what you're saying, Tom, but I just don't want to throw this away yet, because I see there was value here at the beginning, and at the very beginning, there's the horrible Pete Postlethwaite guy. He shows up. He's an old man. Then his son is 7 or 8 years old, and he looks young. And then he goes back to being an old man again 12 years later. It's just horrible. This film is incompetent. But when the hapless fisherman that Kelly described earlier, when they're cruising by the statue of Zeus and the statue is being toppled, do you know what I thought about?
Is it a video game?
Saddam Hussein.
No, I thought about the Taliban.
Hmm.
I immediately thought about the Taliban
blowing up the Buddha statues.
Blowing up the Buddha statues, and I have no feeling one way or the other about Buddhism. I'm ignorant. I couldn't care less. But when those statues were being blown up, I felt this blind rage. I was angry about it, and I thought that could have been harnessed here, that you could have said something about religion and modern religion and.
Yeah.
And the discarding of religion and the use of the gods. And when that statue was going down, there was a moment there where the movie could have sort of co-opted that feeling of passion about religion, whichever way you want to go with it. And instead, it goes into this – it just
murky.
Disregards that. And even the daughter, who I guess is supposed to be – the one who believes in the gods or something, there's no reason. You know, we get to the end, I don't even know why we're supposed to care about Argos. Who cares about the gods other than the Burning Man guy who doesn't really care?
He's an opportunist.
No, this film has no sense of the passion and seduction of mythology, and it goes wrong every step of the way after that.
But it could have, because if we'd seen why the statue was knocked down, we would have been able to sympathize with the humans maybe more.
Well, I think that, Dingus, what you're describing, I think, is somebody maybe making this movie, like perhaps Louis Leterrier, for instance, might actually think that that's in the movie, because I can see where they tried to do a movie about that, you know, where you all these speeches about telling the gods enough and all of this stuff between poor Ralph Fiennes and Liam Neeson and their beards about love and fear.
Yeah.
I really do think that at some point this was a script that addressed those issues, and then in the process of making it a CG video game without any actor, with any sense of presence to anchor it, it lost all of that. But I can see the kernels. I mean, I think probably that's what they were trying to do, and like you were saying, it's incompetent. It's an utterly incompetent movie on so many levels, including the fact that it doesn't even understand what cool things it could have done with its story.
With its special effects. It doesn't even understand how to reveal the simple elegance or power of a reveal. It has no clue about that.
Yeah. Let me propose one quick fix, and I'd be curious what you guys think about this. If you can't be camp, maybe you can be gritty or dark. What do you think? Do you think it would have been helped if this movie had been rated R?
Fuck
yes.
Yeah.
Tons. NC-17. If you know,
go ahead.
I agree with you. I agree that I thought that too. I thought hating the gods as a motivation actually could have been good. And I remember people griping about, or I read that people were griping about that being his motive. But then when I saw the execution, it doesn't jive with anything that happens in the movie. And it's the same speech over and over. I don't know. They didn't give us a reason to agree with Perseus's point.
Well, it was so contrived, Kelly Wand. I mean, all that stuff about I don't want to be like the gods. I mean, how does using this lightsaber that you found, how does that make you less of a man? I don't know if that was ever addressed. I liked the idea that he wasn't going to resort to godly tricks, but you know, if you got a magic lightsaber, use it. It doesn't mean it's going to corrupt
horse.
You. Yeah, exactly. Is it like the ring where if you use it, it corrupts you? None of that was explained. It was just so contrived and it made no sense.
And they keep reminding you that that's why he's doing it when they didn't have to. And he has there's so many easy motivations they could have given him.
Well, and even when they knock when at the end when they knock the makeup off of Jason Fleming, who's been evil guy, and yeah. he says, "Don't be like them." You know, where did that come from? And how do you become like the gods by using the lightsaber and riding the drunken bumblebee Pegasus? None of that made any sense. But if they had made a slight effort, it makes sense. That could have been cool.
That guy's motivation. Yeah, he hates the gods.
Because they did his wife.
Bitch. Right. So then he serves another god to
right.
All right. Whatever. Dumb.
there's no real true believer that we can sort of anchor ourselves to. And there's nothing that Perseus really cares about.
Yeah. And we go into this movie getting excited about Greek mythology and gods. Like, oh, we're going to see some gods throw down. And then the first thing you see is Zeus's statue getting torn down. And everyone talking about how crappy the gods are.
The scenes of Ralph Fiennes appearing in a puff of smoke, like the Wicked Witch of the West or something, those were absurd. Like early on when that happened, I was like, okay, I think maybe that might be cool.
His powers are never clearly defined.
It felt like something they just borrowed from Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Let's just borrow these. Do you have some smoke effects? Oh, you've got an actor, too. We'll take Ralph Fiennes and the smoke effects. Bring them.
And at the end, they set up a sequel. Like, oh, he's still mad that he's somewhere else in hell. Mad about the sequel not being signed yet.
Well, I want to throw out something else that I thought hurt the movie for me personally. Dingus, you probably are on board with this. Kelly Wand, not sure about you. But I thought that the sets and a lot of the effects seemed really chintzy because I am so used to what can be done in a video game, which is 100% CG. You know, if you play God of War, which is very similar thematic material, okay. God of War is not at all bounded by needing a human actor, by having to have some scenes take place in practical sets. You know, when they go into the Medusa's lair in the movie Clash of the Titans, it just looks small and a little ridiculous, and maybe there's some fallen columns. But when you do that in a video game, there's a lot of sense of depth and scale, and God of War is very good at that. So watching this movie, I couldn't help but compare it to what God of War can do as a video game and what this movie just didn't have the budget or the imagination for, and it really hurt it. If there had been more spectacle in this movie, that might have helped it as well, I think.
They always said these action things like in heights, like, oh, you can fall down into this underworld and you're on these ledges. But then no one ever falls from, like, there's never a sense of altitude.
And that's hard. We talked about that bridge scene at the end of Sherlock Holmes. I mean, that can be, that can be hard to do, I guess.
But the threat should be there. Something should break.
Well, they show, you know, when he goes into the Medusa cave, everybody becomes a red shirt, basically. And there was one point in the Medusa cave where somebody died, and I had no idea who it was. And I was like, wait.
But they scream, no!
Yeah, but I thought we knew everybody who went in there, and I realized I was wrong because someone had died, and I was still, my internal head count for, okay, there's that kid, and there's that dude, and there's that dude. Like, my internal head count hadn't changed. I realized that I didn't remember everybody that they brought in. So when one of them died, it didn't matter.
No, they're all interchangeable.
Well, Kelly sort of asked during the movie, who are these people? Why are they going in there? And I whispered to him, so we can have a cool turn to stone effect. And he went, oh, yeah.
Right.
And then the turn to stone effect was either completely nullified by the fact that I was wearing sunglasses, or it was just stupid. It was poorly done. That whole Medusa sequence is, and I would like to talk about ways that just, I would like to break down that just to make it a more interesting sequence. But I would like to talk about that. But before I do that, I do want to talk about what you just talked about, Tom, about the video game thing. Because during the whole Kraken attack, all I thought about was God of War. I thought about finishing God of War 3 and how awful that was, but how there is a sense of space and dimension and the majestic and a sense of the epic. And this, rather than having a sense of the epic, it squeezed it down into into a little tiny cove, and it didn't do anything with size or space or layers or dimension. And it totally lost that. And I was really surprised that because I have the other feeling that a film should be bigger than a video game. But for me, just imagining some of the things that happened at the end of God of War 3, it becomes bigger, and there's much more of a landscape to it. And there was none of that here. There's not even sort of the feeling of Helm's Deep or Minas Tirith in this. And these things have already been laid down. Why can't you do that for us? It just felt so flat and empty.
Can I point out, because what you're talking about, Dingus, there is one shot, one single shot in this movie that I think they got that right. And it's almost like maybe that was a proof of concept that early on they made, and then they went on and built a crappy movie around it. And it's part of what you're talking about, Dingus. It shows a sense of scale. It shows layers. It even gives a sense for place, and it's only one tiny shot. And it's my favorite moment from Clash of the Titans. And let me see if you guys remember this shot. It's in Argos after Cloverfield is attacking, and Sam is riding the drunken bumblebee Pegasus, and every now and then it hits the ground and its hoofs clop, and that's cool, whatever. But then there's one strange shot where it does a sort of a slow motion thing, like Zack Snyder did in 300, that is the camera moving along with the horse. You see a harpy swooping in behind the horse. There's the buildings in the background, and in the background of the buildings, you can see the Kraken sort of mounting the waves coming over. And the composition of that shot is lovely enough that they slow down the action to let you see it. Did that register for you guys? Do you even know the shot I'm talking about?
No, your cat does, so.
I don't, because I was totally thinking about, is the harpy going to steal the bag? What are those harpies doing, and why are they back?
Right.
Yeah.
All right, well, that was one little visual flash, and I was like, you know what? Hey, one thing worked in this movie.
They needed to freeze it longer for me.
I guess so, yeah.
I totally don't remember that. Right. I zoned out whenever the harpies came on. I felt like someone was fluttering their fingers in front of my head.
Until you guys said that, I didn't even realize they were harpies. I just assumed they were like some kind of gargoyle things or something or other. But yeah, that makes sense. They're obviously harpies.
Well, it's just part of Hades. Hades sort of splits off into these things that he flies around, and you don't even see what they're doing in that first scene.
They don't do anything, or carry anyone, or eat anything.
They do knock, yeah, they carry dudes off. They knock them into the ocean and whatnot.
But you can barely see it.
Right.
I mean, and that's the problem, and maybe that's part of what you're talking about with the R rating, which was most obvious for me when, I forget who it is, when the scorpion stabs a guy in the back, and you don't get to see the...
There's no blood.
Well, the thing doesn't poke through the guy's
right.
body.
Right.
He just gets lifted toward the camera as if, you know.
And he's yelling. Yeah. So it can't hurt too much.
So I do want to talk about, because I have some ideas about this, because the Medusa sequence sort of looms large for me, even though it's probably a very small part of the original film, but it looms large for me. And I think that there's a lot you can do with it. And I'm wondering how you can save that, because I think that it should be a key sequence in the movie, and it was totally borked. And I'm wondering if you guys have ideas how you could have saved the film by making the Medusa sequence more interesting.
The snakes would kill people individually and poison them. And
okay.
That's my idea. That's my idea for the pitch meeting. And go.
I really didn't see, I mean, as far as, like, the incompetence of the movie, I actually kind of thought the Medusa scene wasn't as incompetent as other parts of the movie. Like, for instance, the scorpion stuff, that was just so dorky. I want to hear you hold forth something, because the Medusa scene, I actually was like, yeah, okay, I'm less bored now than I am during the other parts of the movie. That's kind of how I felt about it.
It's because they were the same size enemies, so you could kind of buy into it. Whereas with the scorpion, you have to accept that it all get...
Well, and I liked I thought the Medusa herself looked kind of cool, I guess. You know, I liked how they point out, yeah, she was...
I liked her till the lasers came out of her eyes. And then I went, ah, video game, God of War, Tom Chick.
Well, she did a weird, like, Lair of the White Worm thing where her face would change to a snaky-looking face. And
how dare you speak what? Ill of Lair of the White Worm?
I didn't speak ill.
How dare you unfavorably compare Lair of the White Worm to this movie?
But what were your problems with it, Dingus, like, specifically, other than it being in a terrible movie?
It's just that I wish they would have done something different to make her a more interesting and compelling part of the story. And just to have them go in there and have her doing this sinister laugh and running around. I think it would have been far more interesting if they had, since they're glomming on all kinds of things and don't care about mythology anyway, to have made sort of a siren idea with her and have added, because there's so much seductive theme. There's so much seductive going on, seduction going on with the gods. To have made her a character who is more interested in seduction, because she's obviously lonely and cursed, to have had that be more what she's about than just giggling and laughing sinister and sneaking around and popping up and showing lasers at people's eyes.
She's an archer, too.
Yeah, but I think you could have made it a more interesting scene, a more interesting sequence altogether, to have the men have to be attracted to her as well, because only men can go in there. No women can ever go in there. And she's cursed to be in there alone for all eternity. And what does she want? Why does she want to turn people to stone? Just reduce it to that. What is this character? Because it's a character. No matter what you make about it, it's a character. What does she want? And to make it about seduction, that would have made it more interesting for me.
I love that, Dingus, but by golly, there's no room for what you're talking about in this movie.
Of course not. I'm trying to fix probably an unfixable movie. And all I can think of is she's giggling and slithering around.
Well, I thought she was nuts because her punishment was to be there or something. Although that's a good point. I like your idea, too. We should do it. The lasers were seductive to Tom.
I did love how when Draco jumped, there was a Bionic Man sound effect.
Yeah.
Did you notice that?
Wow, I missed that. So
he jumped across a crevasse, and it was like...
So he's got bionic legs. All right.
Yeah, there's the soundtrack made this sort of Bionic Man kind of sound. It was awesome.
Who was your favorite sandwich? The guy who went with them, or one of the other guys who didn't go with them?
Those were gins, first of all. Sandwich works, though.
Sand gin.
That works.
Wait, that's not Greek, is it?
Well, you know, it's a cultural buffet, this movie. Lightsabers aren't Greek either, Kelly Wand.
Sam Worthington's not Greek either.
Boy, and he was like, you know what? I can imagine the director. You know what, Sam? Yeah, we'll make Percy's
Australian. Just do the Australian accent.
Yeah, that's fine. Go with
that.
Yeah,
he was totally breaking into it. Like, has he just lost interest? Like, I played enough of this guy. I've played him for 3 movies now. I didn't see Terminator. Is he good in that? Someone was telling me he was.
No.
I was told today by my mom. Wait, there's more. That he stole the movie. Support that.
I think the only one you could argue stealing the movie, and Dingus, you're going to have to help me out on this guy's name, is the kid from Charlie Bartlett who played Chekhov in the Star Trek movie.
His name.
Yeah, exactly. I think he's the only guy you could possibly, I think, accuse of stealing that movie, and there's not much of a movie to steal in Terminator Salvation. So.
He's young piece, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Is that movie good?
Terminator Salvation?
Yeah.
No.
All right.
Motorcycles drive out of giant robots' legs. That's my synopsis of Terminator Salvation for you right there.
Sims.
Literally. Motorcycles drive out of the legs of giant robots.
You like it because it's Sam Worthington's – it was in 2D.
Right. Well, yeah. It's Sam Worthington in his element. Yeah, so.
Let's get back to Clash of the Titans.
I was just remembering one of my favorite other moments from Clash of the Titans.
Mm.
When Clash of the Titans crossed with my favorite cheerleading movie.
What? Bring It On, All or Nothing?
Yeah, bring it on when he says, be sure to bring it.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Wait a minute. Who says be sure to? Is he talking about his lightsaber or what? What are they wanting him to bring? What?
It's when Ivan Drago says to him, "There's a god in you. Be sure to bring
oh,
it."
Oh yes, right, right.
Like, yeah.
Oh, you better bring it. It was totally, totally a bring it on moment. It was great. I was like, yeah.
What was your? What was y'all's favorite?
And they all abuse him and kick him and. It's a dumb douchebag, demigod.
What was your favorite moment of levity? Because mine would have to be probably the only moment of levity in the movie, at least the only attempt of levity in the movie, where actually there's two. Okay, there's two jokes, and I want you guys to pick which is your favorite joke. Was your favorite joke where they don't bring the golden owl, or was your favorite joke where Sam Worthington makes a joke about being inside of a scorpion?
What was the joke?
I don't know, but he makes a joke and it makes Drago, it makes the other guys laugh and it gives him an occasion to say to Drago, how come you never smile? I think. Oh, you know, oh, here's a joke. It's better to be on a scorpion than in a scorpion.
What? Yeah. I don't remember that line.
Yeah, one of the guys from Willow says, I can't believe we're riding on scorpions. And Sam Worthington says, It's better to be on a scorpion than in a scorpion.
I like that part because it reminded me of Lone Wolf McQuaid when he drives his truck out of the grave. Chuck Norris.
It's good.
Tough for him. So the Boobo joke was in there just for people who would recognize Boobo.
I guess so.
I remember my favorite moment of levity.
Mm. But those were the only two in the movie. There's a third?
No, I remember one, too. You're totally forgetting an awesome.
Okay. Well, Dingus, what's the third? And then, Kelly Wand, you tell us the fourth. What's the third joke in the movie, Dingus?
All right, I'm going to give you just the line, and okay. You're going to have to tell me. You're going to be able to figure it out. Here's the line.
Do it in the right and the correct accent, by the way.
All right. It's not much of a kiss.
Hmm.
Oh, Living Forever? That's not. Is that a joke, though? I don't know if that's a joke so much as like a pithy observation.
It's clearly a moment of levity because she says, you know, my curse is that I have to live forever. And his line is, that's not much of a curse.
Okay. All right, Kelly Wand, what's another joke that we missed?
When they're at Karen's pier and someone goes, oh, I guess you got to be dead to get across the Hell River. And then Draco goes, any volunteers?
But wait a minute. You know what? That's not Draco. That's an actor named Liam Cunningham.
Oh.
Who I always confuse for Jason Isaacs. So I was watching the movie going, wow, Jason Isaacs did this.
They all had the same shtick, though.
Right. It's sort of like, okay, who's going to get the funny line in this scene? I could see Louis Leterrier.
But no one laughed in the audience.
No.
But there's like a beat there where you're supposed to laugh.
Right. Oh, there was, especially at that any volunteers line, there was such a comfortable beat. Like, they wanted to. They wanted
I was
to
thinking, I wonder, is that guy in the audience right now going, oh, no, yeah. Laugh some more. They didn't like any volunteers.
They told Liam Cunningham, okay, hold for laughs after that line.
Because that's a bomb buster.
It's going to kill him. Audience.
It's going to kill him in the cat skills.
I had another favorite funny moment, but it was only funny to me, I think.
Go for it. I imagine Kelly Wand and I will appreciate it.
Well, it's sort of a weird double entendre, or maybe a single entendre, I don't know. And it's this, after feats like yours, men will treat you as one.
It had to be Io, because she had all the stupid lines.
No, it's Zeus talking to Perseus, and he says, after feats like yours... And he's standing between his two feet.
Dingus.
What?
Dingus is easily amused by homonyms.
He's like Peter Sellers on acid.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees when I'm caught in between. Counting 1, 2, 3, feet apart and they're free, getting down with 3 feet.
Too soon? We're done with Clash of the Titans. Is there more? Is there anything else to be said?
No. No one's listening still. No one's going to listen.
Let's get to the
61
good...
million.
That's 64, wasn't it?
It's the best Easter weekend opening ever in 2010.
So we're all idiots for not liking it.
In 3D.
Yeah. Everything always gets a record. Every weekend, something gets a record. How can there be this many records?
Because of 3D? Raising prices, right.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so let's so this week's 3x3 are top three 3D movies that set a record, box office record, on opening weekend, right?
And Easter. Basic Instinct 2.
Jaws 3.
And Friday the 13th, Part 3.
And Halloween Deuce.
All right, Tom, what's next week's 3x3?
Next week's 3x3 are movies in 4D that set records. Because this 3D is so passe now.
Is Sam Worthington, can he do 4D?
We will find.
I've seen him master the 3.
Yeah.
But to cube it.
What is our 3x3 this week? I think we actually have a valid 3x3. And Dingus, I believe it was yours.
What?
Is that rare? A valid one?
All right, this week's 3x3 was about the establishment of place, and it could be as big or as small as you wanted it to be. It was basically inspired by Greenberg last week, because that was in Los Angeles and very clearly in Los Angeles, and contrasted against a film called 500 Days of Summer that claimed to be in Los Angeles but clearly had no sense of that kind of place. But my idea was, what are your three favorite examples, or some of your three favorite examples of establishment of place in film?
And I will be going first because I will be introducing next week's 3x3. My number three is a movie called Annie Hall.
Mm.
Is that allowed, Dingus? Are you going to let me do that?
I only took Manhattan off the table.
Oh, whoops. So... Rats, now I'm stuck with. Wait, you took Manhattan off the table, but not Annie Hall?
Well, I just was doing that as it was basically for me, because one of my complaints last week was that because things like Requiem for a Dream hadn't been taken off the drug table, I felt like I couldn't avoid using them. And in order to open it up so that would push me to find other films, I took Manhattan off the table because it is such a great example of how place is established, you know, and just looking at the poster and just thinking about that film. So that's the only one I took off the table.
Well, I had transposed Annie Hall in there, so I was just doing that to get a rise out of you, and I see now why that didn't work. Instead, I chose – I did not go the easy route of just doing a movie that was also an homage to a city. Because there's plenty of great movies like that, and I'm sure you guys will tell us about some of those. Instead
– Oh, wait. I can't wait to hear your special twist on –
My twist is a sense
it's
of –
It's urban. You suck.
My special twist is movies that just – honored a specific setting, one particular place. I didn't go whole city-wide thing. So I'm going to start with a movie called Session 9 that takes place in, I forget if it's actually called this in Massachusetts or if it's this in the movie, but there's an insane asylum, a mental facility called Danbury's, or whatever, that it was abandoned where they shot the movie. And the movie does an incredible job of making this place a character in this horror film. And it's also just the visuals of this beautiful, beautiful building. And they early on lay out like how the different wings are, you know, the layout of the movie. There's a little of this in Shutter Island, similarly. But I just love the use of that building and the fact that it was a closed down insane asylum, with even a nod towards the fact that Reagan had cut the budget, so a lot of places like this got closed down, which maybe possibly ties into what happens with Peter Mullen's character. It's kind of a stretch. But there was just a slight hint of even a political message there. So the Danbury – now I might be screwing the name up. But anyway, the Insane Asylum in Session 9 is my number three pick.
That's great. That's perfect.
The chair was real. Remember that thing with the chair, that slow tracking shot of the creepy chair?
The wheelchair?
Yeah, that's what I meant. Which is technically a chair, so. It's not technically a wheel. But yeah, they just found that. It's found video.
So. Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of the movie.
It's cheating, because this list should only include people, like, things that people made. Not crazy people, Tom.
What?
If they just found it and it's real, then that means an art director didn't design it, which means it...
Ah, but see, did an art director design Manhattan in Manhattan? No.
Yes, it did. It only showed up.
All right, well, Kellywan, what is your number three, which was obviously designed by an art director and not found?
Yeah, which makes it way better.
Okay.
Crazy Annie. Oh, best picture of the year. Over Phantom Menace. Here's a list. Wait, list? What's wrong with me? Here's a line.
Okay.
I'm moving on my list. Here's some cornbread. Cornbread, yeah.
You're not going to do Aliens, are you? Or Alien?
Yeah! That's got an awesome sense of place. What are you talking about? How dare you?
The Nostromo is...
That's a sense of place for... Because like, everyone will go, oh, yeah, Blade Runner's like the sense of place Ridley Scott movie. But Alien, because there's like that really slow start with just like the ship sounds. And yeah. Everyone's all old. And the alien planet's a sense of place because it's on a bad video headset. That's the key to establishing a sense of place in my universe.
One of my problems with Alien, and I thought about it for this because Alien has beautiful sets. Like it looks great. It has its own great visual. But I never got a sense for what Nostromo actually looks like. And maybe that's its strength.
It doesn't look like anything, yeah. And you don't even know who these people are, whether they're good at their jobs.
Well, and also the relation, like how big it was inside, like it felt more like really really cool sets strung together. But it's not like the ship in, and I hope I'm not trumping anyone, but like the ship in 2001, you know, the Discovery, I think.
Yeah.
By the time I'd seen that movie, I got a sense for, okay, here's where you come into the front of it. Here's where he's like running in the little circular part. Like, I just got more of a sense of the spatial relationships of different scenes in 2001. In Alien, I never really got that.
Well, I got it from 2001, too, but then there's all, like, the Pan Am commercials and stuff, and Pan Am doesn't exist anymore, so all the anachronisms throw me out of it, so I can't pick it. Well, as Alien's timeless.
It certainly does look beautiful, yeah. And why is there a big room with chains hanging from the ceiling and drizzle coming down?
Tom, you're asking too many questions. It's a place. It's a cool set strung together with other cool sets.
Okay. All right.
For me to put on a list, Mr. Woody Allen just showed up. Never mind. Alien Hall is fine. Whatever you call it. All right, that's my worst one. That's the one I'm least proud of.
Okay, but that's still a good one, and it's certainly...
You hate it.
Well, you know, the Nostromo is, this is funny, here's a paradox for you. For a ship that I have no idea what it looks like, the Nostromo is pretty iconic.
It's the only horror movie, okay, Session 9 too, but horror movies that are scary because of, where they are. It's like a scary ship. It's a scarier ship than the one in Event Horizon, which is supposed to be a haunted ship.
Well, that's the deal. I mean, Kelly Wong, what you've just hit on, and you're absolutely right, is a haunted house movie needs a good haunted house. I mean, the haunted house is a character in the movie. And that's exactly what Session 9 is. That's exactly what Alien is.
And it lingers on shots. Like, it lingers on when they dissect the alien. Like, they're all staring at it, fascinated, like, in the thing, too. I don't know. There's a sense of curiosity. And nowadays, in these Clash of the Titans movies, Underworld, they're not impressed by. Ugh. Outrageous.
How do you feel, Kelly Wand and Dingus, about the computer room in Alien, where Sigourney Weaver goes to talk to Mother, with just random white lights everywhere? What, it looks more like a... Are you guys okay with that room?
It's great. It's like a womb, but it's Mother, see?
Well, now you just made me like it. That's kind of cheap, Kelly Wand.
Nicely done.
And then Ash shows up, like, right next to her and goes, "It's weird, isn't it?" or something. And she goes, "What's weird?" And she freaks out. You never find out what he was going to say next. But he's looking at the screen with her, at Mother. See? Sense of place. And it's got magazines on it that he can strangle people with. Sense of place. Winner, number three, Alien.
All right, Dingus, what city is your number three?
My number three is, by the way, I can never, that was from the first Alien. I always forget what the second
The Sulaco. Sulaco.
Thank you. Yeah. All right. For number three, I'm going to give you a line, I think. How about that?
Mm.
And I'm going to use some harsh language. So if there are any children listening, stop listening right now.
He's a good father.
God damn it, you bitch. You never backed away from anything in your life. Now fight!
It's not a city. And we can only have... Oh, good Lord.
Is it precious based on based on Sapphire? The part where she gives birth.
No. Now, Dingus, is it specifically the rig thing, or is it just the whole idea of being underwater? Or actually, you can go ahead and say what it is.
It's I can't believe Kelly Wand chose
this
Cameron film. It's The Abyss, and it is specifically the experimental oil, the underwater oil rig. I'm in love with this as a world. I love that underwater world. I love the way it works. I love the... What are you laughing about, Kelly Wand?
Kelly Wand just now laughing reminded me of the Medusa in Clash of the Titans.
I'm kind of laughing at Tom's disgust for some reason. Like, I don't think it's a bad choice. Tom.
Look, I love the way it's filmed. I love this this underwater oil platform. I love the... I can't really talk too much about it.
Why not?
Any five-letter movie that starts with A is always number three. On
Why can't you talk too much about it?
Let me just say this. I love that it seems completely removed from all that I know, but I can imagine myself living there. I can imagine myself going through some of these things and imagine the danger there. And I just love the underwater oil platform and the world that he creates. I don't think the abyss annoys me in a lot of ways, I don't want to really get into that. But the sense of their world that they have to live with in the abyss, in their oil platform, their experimental oil platform, whatever that is, underwater is great.
One of the things, I'm not a fan of the abyss. I didn't care for it when I first saw it, and I'm not an Abyss fan, but one of the things I love about The Abyss that has to do with this sense of place and how it does feel like a place where people live is that they have those blue 2000 flushes toilet water things in there, and that's a detail that you find out early on. I always loved that he reaches in the toilet and has a blue hand for the rest of the movie.
Right.
I like Abyss until it jumps the shark with the alien ship at the end. It's, like, bigger than the aircraft carrier or whatever that it's on. But it doesn't knock over the aircraft carrier on its side. Like, it's just exactly the right size and exactly the right spot for 300 years.
If you have to wait until that far into the Abyss to take issue with something...
Then I'm an Abyss apologist.
Okay. All right, good. Okay, so The Abyss, number three for Dingus.
Woody Allen snob over here, pretty pissy about the science fiction movies. That's funny, huh? Chris Elliott, hater.
Chris Elliott, by the way, that part of The Abyss is just unconscious.
He stole the movie.
Why are you going to throw Chris Elliott?
Chris Elliott and Ed Harris are always good together, like in Glengarry, when Chris Elliott said his watch costs more than the car.
Wow, I'd like to see that scene.
Oh, jeez.
Recast.
All right, I'm moving on to my number two. And I kind of hate to do this to you guys because I know you haven't seen it. So I won't talk too much about specifics. There's a German movie called The North Face, which is a historical story about the attempt to climb the north face of a mountain in the Alps called the Eiger. It's reminiscent in a way of the race to the moon between the Soviet Union and the U.S. and getting to the moon as a point of pride was a very important thing. Back in 1936, the first climber to ascend the north face of the Eiger, that was a very important thing.
It was Clint Eastwood.
It was an international effort. there's a lot with the Germans and how the Nazis want to use it as sort of a point of political pride. So the way that this mountain is presented in the movie, early on, they have a scene where an old guy explains the derivation of the name. It's called the Eiger because Eiger is German for ogre, and it's known for devouring men. And when they say that, I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. I'm here for a mountain climbing movie. I'm right. It's going to be
not
tough.
Man devouring.
What?
Not man devouring. That's not why you're there.
Anyway, so they throw that as a, an explanation for the name out there, and I remember thinking, whatever. But it really does a good job of creating a character out of this mountain. The way the mountain is shot, the way the movie progresses, the way the characters develop, the sense of place you get about specifically the north face of the Eiger is just phenomenal. I loved this movie. This is a great adventure movie. It's a great sort of historical movie. It's a great. It has some very cool political points. There are three very, very good actors in it. One of the actors you guys will recognize when you see it from White Ribbon. So I think North Face is a movie that it had a very limited release. I hope it'll be out on DVD this year. And what it does with the Eiger, I just thought was phenomenal as far as establishing a sense of place.
What year is it?
This year. I mean, I think it came out in Germany last year, but it was only this year that it was screened overseas. And it ran in L.A., I think, for maybe 3 weeks.
We had a chance to do it for the podcast.
Yes. So, all right. So, Kelly, what's your number two?
I like your choice. I'm sorry I ruined it.
I do, too. I'm really annoyed that we didn't see it. Crap.
Here's a line from my number two. Look, Mr. McCabe, I'm a whore. Now you guys are terrible.
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid?
Tom's quiet again.
McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Good.
If Dingus hadn't said that, I wouldn't have guessed.
Any Altman is sense of place.
Because that's like a Western in the Pacific Northwest, isn't it?
Yeah. And it was also shot like too dark because by accident, like it was a processing issue. And so the film wound up being too dark, and that's why it was considered like a flop at the time. But the darkness, I think, unlike Clash of Titans, too darkness, I think helps that movie a lot. It makes it seem more realistic and like poorly lit like the West was, like in a Deadwood way. And the dialogue just goes nowhere, which is how I think dialogue in the Old West really was.
That's a very good choice, Kelly, because
it
is.
Or Nashville. McCabe and Mrs. Miller always sticks in my head for some reason.
Do you know the name of the settlement? Is it even a town or settlement? Or what is the place where it takes place?
I think it's Portland. No, I don't remember. I can't remember. I haven't seen it in a while. I shouldn't put things on my list I haven't seen in the week.
Well, I do think that is like a great one, Kelly Wan, just for being one of the ones that I thought about. Have you seen The Claim?
No, but I know what it is.
Yeah, the Claim is similar in that it's a Western basically set in the High Sierras, and it's based actually on a Joseph Conrad novel, Mayor of Canterbury, and they for some reason, but it works. They transpose it to the High Sierras, and it's great seeing movies from that era that aren't in Yuma.
What about a guy who sells his wife? It's like an indecent proposal, right?
Well, you know what that is, Kelly Wand? That's in Mayor of Casterbridge. I can't think of the name of the car.
Yeah, it's Thomas Hardy. You're right.
Hardy. Good Lord. Wow. Thanks for saving me on that. That's before the story happens. That happens early on. This guy sells his wife, and then the events of the novel happen. So it's one of the characters' backstory.
That's such a great movie.
Who's the girl?
Who's what girl?
In The Claim.
So let's see. It's Wes Bentley from American Beauty. Mia Jovovich.
Yeah. That's right. See?
But the girl is Sarah Pauly. She plays, and the lead actor, the guy who actually sells his wife, is Peter Mullen, who's also in Session 9. who is this great, great Scottish actor. And he is, to me, he's what makes the claim. As good
he's
as
the main dude in Session 9, right?
Yes, yes.
And who directed the claim?
Michael Winterbottom, who is a fantastic director, of whose movies no two are alike.
John Wayne.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a great Michael Winterbottom one. So all right, there you go. McCabe and Miss Miller is good though. Kelly Wand, I love the Pacific.
Do you remember the ending at all? Yeah.
Of McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Yeah. Are you serious? Of course.
It's
that's
just
a,
good.
That's a great ending.
It's one of those movies where if you describe what happens in it, no one will want to see it. But you'll remember how it made you feel.
Yeah.
It's one
yeah.
of those. It's like the last year of Marion Bad kind of like works on part of your brain, not the forebrain, not the reptilian part. Corpus Colossum. Thank you.
And who directed that, Kelly Wand?
Corpus Colossum? That was Stuart Gordon, I believe.
Dingus, have you seen McCabe and Mrs. Miller?
Yeah, but it's been a long, long time. And it's so dark, you can barely see it. I was wearing sunglasses.
Kelly Wand, do you remember the tagline that
Major Poison?
Warren Beatty has? I don't know, it's a tagline. It's like a recurring, like, throwaway joke that he makes.
Think I'm stupid?
I'm your Huckleberry.
Doesn't he have some, he at least a couple times says something about, yeah, and if a frog had,
he would bump his,
ass, bump his ass when he jumped. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. See?
Which
good,
I just
right?
love how dopey that is. And
yeah,
he doesn't realize
dopey
it's too. Dopey. Yeah, yeah. I love Warren.
I like Warren Beatty's a dope. And I'm an Ishtar apologist. There, I said it.
I'm a Woolworth apologist.
You said you're an Ishtar apologist at least in two other podcasts, so don't act like that's a confession, Kelly Wand.
Yeah, Kelly Wand, you might as well get that printed on your business card.
I'm unapologetic. I think the songs are awesome.
What other movie has if a frog had wings, he wouldn't bump his ass a hoppin'?
Legend of Kel?
Willow?
No. Willow.
Dingus, whatever what you're asking right now is way too obscure for mortal men.
All right.
You're just going to have to tell us.
We'll just put that as this week's contest.
Oh, what do they win?
They win a copy of Raising Arizona.
Mm.
Oh,
uh-huh.
Oops.
All right.
On VHS.
All right, Dingus, what is your number two movie? And I know this is good. Finally, someone's going to come up with a city one, I'm sure. Movie that gives you a sense of place. And what city is it set in that is given a sense of place?
The city is Atlantis. No, it's not. I'm not going to tell you the city, but I am going to tell you the director of the film, and you're going to tell me the film. How about that?
Okay.
Because we've already mentioned this director's film when we were talking about Clash of the, what was it? Titians? This director's name is Wolfgang Petersen.
Oh, enemy mine. No.
In the Line of Fire.
Yeah.
Faraway play or never ending story.
Down and out Beverly Hills.
You're not picking Heathers. Troy, are you?
I love you guys so much. This is why I really couldn't talk. I felt like I couldn't talk about The Abyss very much because this is a film with a sense of place that
Other
trumps
water.
The Abyss. And this is Das Boot. And this is from 1981.
Dingus, a submarine is not a place. It's a vehicle.
Oh.
Submarine is not a place. It's a vehicle. How dare you?
The big bus was a place and a vehicle, Tom. Take that.
I don't know.
You feel silly, don't you?
But you know what else? I get. You know, Kelly Wand, the Nostromo isn't a place either. It's a vehicle.
Oh, if it's big enough, it's a place. The Earth is a place and the Earth's a vehicle. We're
revolving
around the sun.
Both of Dingus's, by the way, Dingus, the experimental oil rig, because it's mobile, is also a vehicle. So far, you have not picked a single place. You have instead picked vehicles.
Oh, MacGuffins can't be car engines. It says on IMDb Pro, I get a free thing because I go to GDC.
All right, well, tell us about Das Boot, Dingus. It's about a boot?
It's about this enormous shoe that a bunch of people live in.
I love this choice, and I totally agree with you, Dingus.
I'm going here for the world. It's just about films that create a world for me, and this sense of place in this German U-boat. When I was talking about this, I was definitely thinking about Manhattan and a couple of their cities, and I started eliminating obvious ones. But the abyss occurred to me right away, and then I started thinking about this film and how great it understands its sense of place, and I love the abyss. I have a very sentimental attachment to the abyss, even though it's not a very good movie. Because I loved the world that it created. But the world of the German U-boat and the claustrophobia and the darkness and the water, I can't help but think of this film. And I really like, I feel guilty saying this, but I really like The Hunt for Red October a lot. I was working in a movie theater when The Hunt for Red October came out, so I saw it over and over and over and over and over again. And I had already read the book. And
Nerd
I,
alert.
Yeah,
what?
Seriously.
You read the book?
Yeah.
Bruce Kerr.
I read a lot of Tom Clancy. And I really liked The Hunt for Red October. But there is so much space in those submarines. You could have a basketball court in there. And they don't really understand or seem to understand, as far as I'm concerned, from a cinematic point of view, what a submarine should feel like. And the boat does. There's just so much in this film that gets it right. And when I think about it, really a sense of place and the way that the boat is filmed, this film just gets it.
That means now there are two German movies.
You know? They're also all claustrophobic, submergence, dingus themed. He has a fear of drowning. He's a drownophobe.
Who loves vehicles. Dingus, I'm going to guess your number one is Christine.
Does Christine ever go underwater, though? No, it's actually Phantom Menace when they're in that little submersible.
Ah, there's always a bigger fish, right? Right.
My
number one movie that establishes a sense of place is Barton Fink for The Hotel Earl, which is, I guess in some sense you could think of it as a metaphor for the human condition or Barton Fink's state of mind, but just the way that it's got a weird little pale Steve Buscemi tending to it, shining people's shoes, the way the wallpaper peels and it's oozing glue, the way it breathes, the pipes in it, the way you hear the other people through the walls. The Hotel Earl is probably one of the, I think, most vividly established buildings in a movie, and I don't think you ever see it from the outside, do you? Is there ever an establishing shot in Barton Fink of the Hotel Earl?
There is no outside. You're in the box the whole time.
Is that the case, Kelly Wand? I mean, because I think of, for instance, Session 9 and even the Hotel Overlook and The Shining. Like the easy way is you show how cool it looks from the outside. But the Hotel Earl is built from the inside, and I don't even know if you ever see it from the outside.
I can't remember a single exterior. I can remember one now from Barton Fink.
Of the Hotel Earl? Or
kisses his shoe. No, in the Hollywood. Okay. Yeah, none of the hotel.
Yeah, I don't even know if you ever see it from the outside, and you don't have to, because they do such a good job of establishing it.
Tom, that hotel's a vehicle, though, so in a way.
It does not move. It does not move. It's stationary.
No, he moves it with his mind.
I'll show you the life of the mind.
Will you show us the life of the mind?
I always hate my list. You guys always...
Well, what do you got for number one?
Are you done talking about Barton Fink?
I am. Yep.
All right, tell me if you remember this. Of seeing this line in a movie. My favorite actor is Patrick Swayze. I'd pay to touch him.
Do not think I know that one.
I don't. I don't know it either.
Oh, I thought we were just going to wait till you guys...
Roadhouse.
This shitty-ass rabbit stinks. I know. He smells like pussy. No? All right. You guys ever saw Gummo?
No.
Did not.
Oh, I see a movie you guys haven't seen? That's hard.
I don't think I've ever... What has Harmony Korine done? I know I've seen a Harmony Korine movie, but I just don't think I've seen Gummo.
Didn't she do Kids, too?
First of all, he's a dude.
But, yeah, Harmony.
Isn't Kids that Larry Clark, or no, what's his name?
Greg.
I've seen Harmony Korine in The Last Days, the Gus Van Sant movie about Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, I knew it was Harmony,
Where Harmony Korine plays a guy who he runs into at a concert, and Harmony Korine is wanting to tell him about his Dungeons and Dragons game that they've been playing. I love that scene. But no, I have not seen Gummo.
And that didn't prompt you to see Gummo?
It did not, I'm afraid. I've heard that it's, I can see the...
He wrote Kids, that's what I'm thinking of.
Okay. Yeah.
And Julian Donkey Boy, you didn't see that?
Nope, never seen that. As a matter of fact, I think I've conflated in my mind Julian Donkey Boy and Gummo for a long time.
I definitely recommend Gummo to you, not so much to Dingus. I think Dingus would not get far into it. But you, I think, you like kind of redneck humor stuff.
And what is the place that
I think it's Ohio. It's some small town in Ohio, not a city and not a vehicle. it's just a bunch of, it's like Slacker, but like a bat, like an evil Slacker. Like the Richard Linklater Slacker movie.
Right.
But sad and depressing and miserable and creepy. It's like it's like a deglamorized Jackass.
Is Gummo like, Southern Gothic, Kelly Wand?
No.
Okay.
Because there's no story. It's just, it feels like a documentary. Or, I don't know.
And are there any actors that I'd know in it?
Bunny Boy. Close to Vinny's in it as Dot. Do you know who she is?
Do not.
She's a kid. Yeah. She,
Chloe Sevigny. Yeah, right. The way you said her name. Yeah, I totally know who that is.
Did I going to say it? Probably
I couldn't tell.
Kind of was hard to describe if you didn't. It's just a depressing, antisocial, juvenile, sad movie.
What makes it a great sense of place?
It's just a miserable small town that no one seems to be working in at any time, and just what they do to kill time, and it just gets creepy.
Well, at least it's not a vehicle. I'll grant you that. what's your number one movie that establishes a sense of place? What city? Finally, Kelly almost picked a city. So is it maybe 8 Mile for its portrayal of Detroit? Maybe is it something like that?
Do you want to get? I mean, you guys should just guess a bunch of movies. That's what.
I'm surprised nobody's done a city yet. I thought I was going to be like the outlier here.
Gummo is a movie about a haunted town that affects all the citizens. It's like The Crazies, but it's if the town was the curse and not.
Is it like The White Ribbon, Kelly Wand?
Yeah, it's like White Ribbon, but made by rednecks.
Okay.
Thank you, Tom. I take that. But that's a German movie. All right. Sorry, Dings.
That's right. All right. I'm going to hit you guys with a quote. How do you like that?
All right. I think we can take it.
Here's the quote.
Truly.
I'll hit you so hard, I'll kill your whole family.
Oh. Okay, it's either The Untouchables or Raw Deal.
I considered The Untouchables for a moment. That's not a bad sense of place.
Chicago way.
Yeah, you're not from Chicago.
Tom's stumped.
Yeah, I don't think I know it. When you say that, Dingus, I think of Jack Black and Margot at the Wedding. Or he says he insists that he's punched people. And Jennifer Jason Leigh says, "Who have you punched?" He says, "You don't know them. They're not around anymore because I punched them." So I don't know. I'll hit you so hard it'll kill your whole family. I don't think I know this one. Have I seen
Punch
it?
Drunk Love?
You have seen it. It is not Punch Drunk Love.
Does The Rock play a tooth fairy in it?
There is no Rock. There is no tooth fairy.
So it's obviously not that one where the cows stampede over Christopher Walken, The Rundown.
No.
Okay.
There is a quote from Greenberg in this movie, though.
Life's Waste on a People?
No, it's Fuck or Fight.
Oh. Bad Boys with Sean Penn.
No.
When do they say that in Greenberg?
Something Iron?
He says that during the second party. Fuck or Fight.
Wow.
So he's quoting this movie.
Yes, he is. Most definitely.
The Warriors.
Right, one more quote for you, and I think Tom will finally get it on this quote. Say the words, "I want the roast beef sandwich."
falling down?
It's got to be Schumacher. Carbon copy.
It's not Schumacher. It's not carbon copy. And it does actually have a city. So finally, Tom, you get your city. You'll be the outlier you always wanted to be. The city we're talking about is Baltimore.
Oh, the one where Ben Affleck fails to prevent it from getting nuked. No. Some of all beers.
No. Gone, baby, gone.
John Waters.
Baltimore? What the heck?
This is one of my favorites. This is one of my favorite cities for film. This is probably second. Yes, thank
you. Oh, good Lord. Barry Levinson. Okay.
Baltimore is a lot more directors than I would have thought when I had to guess.
And Baltimore is a great city for filming. It's a great city for TV, too. It's one of my favorite of all time television series. It's not The Wire. It's Homicide. Because I haven't seen The Wire, I'm sorry to all of you who love The Wire. It's Homicide.
Same guy, same creator.
Yes, it's David Simon. But Diner and the other films Barry Levinson did. But The Diner. And this is a twofer because of the place of the diner itself and then of Baltimore itself. Including the accents. And no, I'm not going to do a Baltimore accent for you. This might be my favorite fictional / real city after New York. I love this place. I love how Barry Levinson loves it in this movie. I love the accents. I love it. I love the way the film captures those things and the time. I think this film is set in 1959. It's the late 50s. And it's perfect. It captures the diner itself as well, and that whole idea of diners. But this specific diner and the way the film sets the city, it is such a gorgeous sense of place. I love the diner.
This explains why you did the popcorn trick to me during Clash of the Titans.
Yeah, I'm not going to dust for fingerprints, by the way.
Ooh. I don't have a sense for a Baltimore accent. What does a Baltimore accent kind of sound like?
Yeah, what does that sound like, Dingus? What are you talking about?
I already told you I wasn't going to do that.
Oh, that's good.
Is it basically just a New York accent?
It is not. It is not at all.
What actor is from Baltimore? Like, who sounds like he's from Baltimore?
That one guy. Watch Diner. The guys in that sound like they're from Baltimore.
Steve Guttenberg sounds like he's from Baltimore?
No.
Kevin Bacon?
Kevin Bacon is in Diner?
Isn't he?
Yeah. Kevin Bacon, Mickey Rourke.
I knew Mickey Rourke and Steve Guttenberg were.
Tim Daly?
From Wings?
Yeah, you bet.
What?
Aha, Tom knows Wings. Yay!
Wow.
Watch the movie and listen to the guy who saves Mickey Rourke, the guy who pays Mickey Rourke's debt. He's got a great sort of Baltimore accent.
All right.
Eric Roberts?
It's not Eric Roberts. Stop it.
Is Eric Roberts in Diner?
No.
Oh. All right.
No,
good.
But Paul Reiser is, and he's great.
Oh, right. I think I knew that. Yeah, all right.
Huh. I like your choice. Is that the one where Richard Dreyfuss hits Danny DeVito's car and Good Thing?
Yeah. That's exactly the movie.
Is that the one where Robin Williams makes toys, but the army buys them?
And then Tom Cruise is autistic, and he has to have sex with a sailor.
And Men in Black. Oh, wait. Oh, yeah. Sailor. Tina and Sailor.
So I wanted to mention a movie. This didn't make my list because I was actively avoiding cities. When we talked about 500 Days of Summer on the forum and how it was obviously not written to be set in Los Angeles, but it got shot here for whatever reason. So it basically was a script crammed into Los Angeles with no consideration for whether or not that might work, which it absolutely didn't. But one of the guys recommended a movie to me called Medicine for Melancholy, which is called that not because of anything that happens in the movie, but because I think that's the name of a song that they play. But Medicine for Melancholy, it's not a great movie, but it's a very good movie for what it does with San Francisco, with the Bay Area. It's a day. It's a 24-hour period after two people have met each other at a party and had a one-night stand. And it's the course of them over the next day. And it's equally about their relationship. You could sort of say it's like a romantic comedy, maybe. And about San Francisco. And it is so intrinsic to the way people in the city get around, to what they do. And it even has a scene, and I love that it did this, where later in the movie, the next night, the characters walk past the open door of what looks like some sort of a neighborhood committee meeting where they're talking about rent control and gentrification. And the characters are just sort of, they walk past the door, and I think maybe they pause and look in. But for no real good reason other than the movie loves San Francisco, the movie goes in and hangs out at the committee meeting for a while. And we see different people talking in this committee meeting about rent control in San Francisco. And then the movie goes back out to the two characters and sticks with them. But it was recommended to me as an example, as a counter to 500 Days of Summer, a movie that is so intrinsically involved with a specific city. And I love how San Francisco is such a huge part of medicine for melancholy.
My honorable mentions were Sid and Nancy, Quest for Fire, Open Water, The Good Earth, and Airport 77, which had air and water. See?
Okay, good. Dingus, what did not make the cut for you?
Cairo from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Now, that's not a MacGuffin, you know.
Oh, crap.
All right, next week's 3x3.
Actually,
go ahead.
Sorry, there was one that I flirted with called Local Hero that is in Ireland.
Oh, is it that Burt Lancaster thing?
Is that the one with John Ritter?
Oh. No.
It's not the Burt Lancaster one?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, okay, right.
The Ritter's in it?
No. Oh.
Yeah, it's...
Peter Riegert.
Oh, yeah.
Peter Riegert.
He's like a representative from an oil company, or... I still don't remember. I don't remember that. What is the premise of it?
Who plays Ritter?
He has to... Mr. Robus. He has to go to this town and co-opt them, basically. And it's this wonderful little Irish town. And I just got a real sense of... There's a really lovely television show called Valley Kiss Angel, and this really has nothing to do with this, but I really love Ireland, and Valley Kiss Angel is this sort of lighthearted BBC series that's set that sort of follows this priest who goes into this small Irish town, and it made me think of Local Hero and just the way that this small town Ireland is set. And we've talked a couple of times about small towns, and I really like the small town feel of the town in Local Hero, where Peter Riegert is this guy who has to come and convince these people to sign away their rights. And he sort of gets charmed by them. And it's just got a wonderful sense of this little town place.
Good. What's the name of the town?
It's called Kilmarnock.
Did you just make that up?
Yeah.
That was good, though. Very well played, Dingus. Well
done. Who's Marnick?
He's played by John Ritter.
So good.
So next week's 3x3, very simply, I want you guys to come up with three double features that you have to explain. Now, let me explain a little bit.
What?
For instance... I just want three double features from you guys, but you can't just do something like we saw Clash of the Titans this week. So you're thinking Clash of the Titans and 300.
Ugh.
Wrong. That's not what I want you to do because nobody needs to explain that double feature. That's for one thing, one of the movies is stupid. The other one. But so don't do obvious things. For instance.
Wait, what's Clash of the Titans in that one?
Here's what you would do with Clash of the Titans. Pairing Clash of the Titans and Passion of the Christ, because they're both movies about fathers using their sons to save humanity, for instance, if you were going to go that route. So what I want you to do is come up with three double features. Presumably these are movies that you would actually want people to see, and I want you to have to explain why it's a double feature. Does that sort of make sense?
So it has to be convoluted enough to fill up.
Well, I really don't think it's convoluted. I mean, it shouldn't be convoluted, but it should require some sort of explanation. I mean, that's kind of obscure. The one about Clash of the Titans and Passion of the Christ is a joke, because I wouldn't recommend anybody watching Clash of the Titans. But if, by some stretch of the imagination, Clash of the Titans turned out to be the good movie that Dingus was describing earlier, I could sort of see that. They're both – and Passion of the Christ is a bit different anyway. But, yeah, I guess you're right, Kelly Wan. Convoluted enough that you have to explain it. But it should make sense, and you should actually believe that they go together as a double feature.
It has to be interesting enough for us to podcast about. That's what you're
like,
saying.
Like, I would pair Clash of the Titans and A Serious Man.
What?
There you go. Questioning man's relation to God. Yep. Is that where you're going, Dingus?
Well, there's also a very strong Job kind of a feel when Hades is up there saying, do nothing, let me have my way.
I'm not going to go with you there, but okay, I get what you're saying. So I just want three double features, and this, by the way, is one reason, and this will be a teaser, why I need you guys to see Orphan before next cast.
So, I have a bond.
There you go. So tune in next week for the 3x3, double features that you have to explain. That's the pithy title there. We will present our double features and explain them. So actually next week is kind of 3x6? Did I do the math right? Yeah. 6x6. No, wait. That would be 36 movies. 3x6 is 18. We're each doing two movies.
Tom, you're so stoned.
This is awesome.
And also we will be seeing Hot Tub Time Machine, right?
Yay!
Yeah, all right. So it's been out long enough where everybody listening should have seen it as well, so we won't be spoiling it because you've already seen it. We haven't seen it yet. We're going to. We'll be back next week to talk about it. I am joined with Christian Murdaski.
Christian Murdaski.
And Kelly Wand.
Medicine for Melancholy is a lesser Bradbury.